by the summit and SALDA yesterday, and all of us agreed that in the bill, as we have seen it, it is to then meet and then come out with some form of proposal, both on the definition. There was a proposal, a certain definition they suggested, to also meet to deal, I think, with a section. You could see already that the bill itself didn't have in mind the medical devices, even though they mentioned medical devices in certain sections that were actually drafted. And also another consequent thing that you actually raised. And as you do so, you must also take into account, I think, Discovery Life then raised the question of the sampling and bonuses, bonusing with regards to this particular industry, in particular, your SALDA, your SAMET. And one of the things they were raising is even though SAMET was saying, in order for us to submit our products in the various industries to be certified as right to be bought, they must first sample. But Discover was making certain cautions around some of those things. But I think there was a gentleman now, I don't see him here, who then alerted me that it's not as easy a straightforward road as he suggested. I think he was saying, I think he's dealing with advertising standards. Right, there was a gentleman who was with us. I think he said there will be a rep of from him who will be present today. But he was saying, why is the medical industry suggesting such a thing? Let's look at it more carefully. And I'm hoping that maybe we'll have to do that in the whole presentation that will then come. I'm hoping the department at some point, when ready, we together with SALDA Summit will come back to us and deal with those aspects. And then there's this very vexing and intricate aspect with regards to certification and registration. And again, I think from various quarters, you could actually see that we'll have to exercise our mindset. I'm just refreshing some of the things that we ourselves have to look into. Thank you very much, Pick and Pay, for joining us. Masai, hand over to you, sir.
Good morning. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, honorable members, ladies and gentlemen. It may be surprising that a company like Pick and Pay comes to public hearings like this on the Medicines and Related Substances Amendment Bill. However, Pick and Pay, as a very large organization, does have various product ranges, and it also includes a chain of pharmacies, which is growing. It's a fairly new business, but I think it's quite important just to understand the context. To give a bit of a background, Pick and Pay Retailers, as we all know, is a very well-known chain. I think that a turnover of $45.4 billion as of 29 Feb 2008. They also operate a chain of pharmacies, primarily in the Pick and Pay hypermarkets, but that will expand in the future. And they are well-known in the marketplace as a discounter of foodstuffs, nutritional products, vitamin supplements, and now medicines, both under their own brands and supplier brands. What are the issues which we would like to raise? Well, the issues as we see them from the Pick and Pay perspective would be the supplements and vitamins, foodstuffs, Schedule Zero medicines, unregistered medicines, complementary medicines. On a more basic level, perhaps, what is the purpose of the Foodstuffs, Cosmetics and Disinfectants Act, and what is the purpose of the Medicines and Related Substances Act? As regards the first issue, the supplements and vitamins, inside the Department of Health there are obviously various directorates, and one of the directorates is the Directorate of Food Control. And they are currently drafting regulations in terms of the Foodstuffs, Cosmetics and Disinfectants Act, which will regulate nutritional supplements and vitamins. Supplements and vitamins are widely believed to be a crucial part in health support of the immune system of immune-compromised individuals and people with other illnesses. The inclusion into the Medicines and Related Substances Act of such supplements and vitamins will severely limit access to supplements and vitamins by the poor, especially the rural poor, who may no longer be able to just go into a Pick and Pay and purchase these products. Why is inclusion of these types of products likely to reduce stocking thereof by Pick and Pay? Well, sections 12 to 14 of the bill, which are the section 18 of the Principal Act, impose restrictions on marketing similar to medicines. There will be no bonusing allowed, for example, the rebate system. There will be no sampling of products allowed in respect of supplements and vitamins. The effect of Section 22 of the Principal Act, which is Section 26 of the bill, I think actually it's Section 27 of the bill, is the restriction of where Pick and Pay may purchase such products. Typical turnaround of supplements on shelves is much slower than foodstuffs, and over-regulation makes it not viable to stock these products. To give you an idea, I mean, a can of baked beans will be turned around in a day or so, or even less, on the shelves of a big supermarket like Pick and Pay. But something like a nutritional supplement or a vitamin may only be turned around twice a month. So that bottle stands on the shelf and takes space for a much longer time. So it shouldn't be limited so broadly by this bill. Foodstuffs, Cosmetics and Disinfectants Act. Well, as we all know, it's administered by the Department of Health, the Directorate of Food Control. And in terms of that legislation, there are certain regulations. There's the food labeling regulations, which as they currently stand, and there at regulation 29C, there's a prohibition on the words such as heal, cure, restorative, or any other medicinal, therapeutic, or prophylactic claim on foodstuffs. So it's already dealt with under the current food labeling regulations. What's more important, possibly, is that the Department of Health has spent the last 5, possibly now 6 years, developing new labeling and advertising regulations, which were published in Government Gazette. We all know that number by now. But in that, Regulation 14K prohibits the word cure or any other medicinal claim, except those health claims permitted in terms of those regulations. Regulation 52, 60, and 62 will regulate health, nutrition, and disease reduction claims in great detail. If anybody's interested, I can call it up and I can show them to you on the screen. But it goes into very great detail as to what you can, what you can't say, under what circumstances you can make so-called medicinal or health claims. What is the purpose of the Medicines and Related Substances Act in contradistinction to the Food, Cosmetics, Disinfectants Act? It's also administered by the Department of Health. However, I believe its main objective is to regulate medicines and related substances. The Act is littered with references to doctors, dentists, etc. I didn't see any reference anywhere to food retailers, premises where foodstuffs are made, etc. For example, if one was to look at Section 19 of the bill. However, now, the introduction of foodstuffs into the definition of product introduces foodstuffs into the ambit of this Medicines and Related Substances Act, which I don't believe is the correct place for this, for foodstuffs to come up in. It will certainly, as I raised earlier, of course, there's regulations which are coming up now which will deal with this in great detail. And if we were to include foodstuffs as well under the Medicines and Related Substances Act, it could lead to uncertainty and duplication of functions of the various directorates within the Department of Health. From the perspective of the public, who would they go complain to the food directorate regarding the labeling, or would they go to the medicines department regarding the fact that they now claim it has a medicinal claim? The application of medicines procedures to foodstuffs, supplements, and the like will be detrimental to the end user, as it will drive up the costs of these products. As we all know, the processes, even if they are refined, as was discussed yesterday, are very onerous and time-consuming. When we come to now the medicines in which Pick and Pay also has an interest, as we heard yesterday, Schedule 0 medicines and complementary medicines are exempt from the provisions of Section 18A and 22 of the Principal Act, already since 2004, and I believe an extension has been obtained until 2010. Unregistered medicines, such as those which could be called up for registration in terms of the bill, should also be subject to this exemption. However, our submission is that the exemption should not be discretionary in later regulations, but should be already in the bill, or alternatively, and this may be something worthwhile considering, The bill should include a review by the Portfolio Committee of all regulations in terms of this bill, so that if the Portfolio Committee finally decides that the Minister should have the discretion to make regulations, we would urge that a callback clause be inserted, as happened, I think, in the Correctional Services legislation recently, where the Portfolio Committee has the opportunity to review regulations before they become law, to ensure that these types of things are, in fact, contained there. As we all know, the poor rely on these medicines. By these medicines, I'm referring to the Schedule Zeros, the unregistered medicines, for symptomatic relief, etc. And the competition between retailers keeps prices down. I'm sure we've all seen the big color spreads where Disprins are advertised and Rennies and all sorts of other medications. So there's keen competition on these products at the moment, which is keeping these products affordable. The purpose of the FCD and MRS Act, just to recap, the Foodstuff Cosmetics and Disinfectants Act is there to ensure food safety, to require proper informative labeling of foodstuffs, to prohibit false health, nutritional and other similar claims on foodstuffs, to interact with food manufacturers, retailers, etc. The Medicines and Related Substances Act, which is what we are here to discuss today, deals with market approval of medicines, regulates the pricing and distribution channel of medicines, and interacts with the pharmaceutical industry, doctors, and dentists. As we can see, there's a disconnect if you introduce foodstuffs. Proposed solutions. It's easy to criticize. What would be the solutions? Well, our solution would be to exclude all foodstuffs from the bill. However, if the committee decides that is not the way to go forward, then we would say, let us adopt a definition for medicinal claims. Let us amend section 27 or 26 of the bill, which is section 22H of the Act, to remove unforeseen consequences around wholesalers selling foodstuffs. To amend section 7 of the bill, which is section 15(7) of the Act, to reduce the administrative burden on small companies that manufacture foodstuffs which could be considered to fall under the bill. What amendments would I propose? Well, I would propose a new definition for medicinal claims. How did I come up with this definition? If one refers to the new shorter Oxford Dictionary, then the word medicinal has a specific clear meaning. And the word medicinal in the Oxford says, having healing or curative properties or attributes. It's very short and sweet to the point. And it's quite clear, one can pick up something and fairly reasonably determine, does something have healing or curative properties or not? I would therefore introduce a definition of medicinal claims which says, claims directed at the curing or healing of a recognized medical condition or illness of the human body by a foodstuff. And we believe that if that amendment is brought in, it will avoid a lot of the difficulties which arise with the foodstuff suddenly being introduced into the Medicines and Related Substances Bill. A second amendment that we would propose, and again I apologize, it should actually be section 27, not section 26, which is 22H of the Act, of the Principal Act. No wholesaler shall purchase, and there we have the word medicines, which appeared previously. The amendment which is proposed by the Department of Health is products. I've deleted the word product and I've replaced it with medicines or medical devices from any source other than the original manufacturer or for the primary importer of the finished product. In other words, we don't want Pick and Pay to be limited to purchasing its foodstuffs from the original manufacturer or from the primary importer of the finished product. There may be other channels more suitable for foodstuffs. As regards Section 7 of the bill, which is 15(7) of the Act, we take issue with the period of validity. So what we are saying is any certification of registration under this section shall be valid for a period of 5 years, and then we add, in the case of medicines and medical devices, and indefinitely until revoked in the case of cosmetics and foodstuffs, and may be made subject to such condition as may with regard to, etc., etc. I haven't changed any of that. So our point is that if you do insist that foodstuffs have to go through this registration process, let's at least not make it every 5 years. You know, once you've shown that an apple is healthy, do we need to go back in 5 years and again show that this apple is healthy? When it comes to foodstuffs, these things shouldn't change. And that's the end of the presentation. I don't know if there are any questions, issues people would like to raise.
Thank you very much. We can pay Mr. Lutherick for your submission. Members, Dr. Rabinovitz.
Helped us in some way by giving us a definition, because this is the problem. But you're not helping us when you talk about our wanting to regulate an apple. Okay? You must realize there's a gray area. And the gray area is where people take these things that you're so worried about the poor not getting, which cost them 88 rand and consist of rubbish, which people make claims about, but very subtle claims and small writing somewhere inside. So if you're happy with it being in the cosmetics bill, the food and cosmetics bill, would you be happy with the same thing being in this bill? The bills have got to talk to each other. So whether it's there or here, we're looking at the issue now. It needs, we think, to be regulated so that people don't make dishonest claims. We don't believe that the industry can look after itself, or that people even know, or companies even care, to go and make complaints if somebody's making false claims. So what do we do about the grey area where rubbish medicine is sold with rubbish claims, subtle claims? And it's vitamins, it's various kinds of enhanced foods. I can think that, for example, genetically modifying certain foods to claim that they might have vaccine properties. I'm going ahead. What do you do about that kind of stuff?
Thank you very much, Honourable Member. I think possibly the example of an apple was not a good example. It's something that came up at the last sort of the top of my head. But I think it's quite clear that in terms of a foodstuff or even a vitamin or a nutritional supplement, once it's been approved, why would one want to go back every 5 years to get it reapproved? You know, it's not likely to be like a medicine which they later discover some side effect. Possibly that's why you need to have it reapproved after 5 years. So on the level of the reapproval, I think foodstuffs and nutritional supplements and vitamins should definitely be separated from medicines as such. On the regulatory aspect, I think that all of this will be regulated by the Department of Health. No one is saying it shouldn't be regulated. No one is saying, well, certainly we're not saying it shouldn't be regulated. It should definitely be regulated. It should definitely be regulated by the Department of Health. What concerns us is that inside the Department of Health, there's a Directorate of Food Control, and they control food. And they, in the labeling regulations, which have taken 6 years already to draft, they've gone into the nth degree to deal with what you can say, what you can't say, under what circumstances you can say something on foodstuffs. And I would really urge that people read this before we take a decision on including foodstuffs into this bill, because the Directorate of Food Control has really gone a long, long, long way with dealing with all of these issues. They have exhaustive lists of under what circumstances you can claim that something reduces the risk of this disease or that disease. So it's all been dealt with, not by us, by the Department of Health. What we are saying is let that department continue down the path that it started 6 years ago and complete its job and put those regulations in place, and then all of these things will be regulated. On a second note, the Department of Health is currently busy with the nutritional supplements and vitamins regulations. How do I know this? I sit on FLAG, the Food Law Advisory Group for the Minister. And we are busy at the moment. They are drafting these regulations. So they are dealing with them as a completely separate animal, which is, again, where it belongs, because it's not a medicine. And one can argue it's not a foodstuff, so therefore it should be dealt with separately. But trying to include it into a bill, which is always its prime objective since 1965, was to deal with medicines, and it's directed at pharmaceutical companies, at doctors, at dentists. So suddenly now to try and introduce things which also belong under the Department of Health, but under a completely different directorate, I think is not going to lead to the solution that we want, to regulate these things properly, to prevent quacks making strange claims on pills. Pick and Pay is the first one to put its hand up to say that's rubbish, it's nonsense. They will not allow that to happen. They have laboratories that check things, etc. But, of course, we have to regulate the mavericks out there. What I'm saying, it's got to be regulated, but let's regulate it under the correct directorate within the Department of Health. But I hope that maybe illuminates the situation.
I'm just interested in your last slide on the last page, slide number 3 on the last page. I just want to find out which other sources are you purchasing from other than the manufacturer and the primary importer of the finished product. Which other sources are you referring to?
Thank you, Honourable Member. It may be that you purchase from another wholesaler. In certain situations where you're only taking a small amount of product, even though Pick and Pay is very big, it may be that certain products are only purchased on a smaller scale because there's not such a big demand, but yet they do want to supply it, they want to give their clients a choice. Then they would be buying it themselves from a wholesaler, or from a, lack of a better term, a distributor. So that would be the scenario, one scenario. There might be others that I can think of. Thank you.
Chairperson, thank you very much. In your response to Honourable Rabinowitz, to me, anyway, it's my view, you have raised a number of issues which says to me there is a confusion at the end of the day in terms of what you have said. For instance, you have made mention of the Act of Foodstuffs, the Cosmetic and Disinfectant Act. Then are you saying this bill, as it is of now, takes some privileges of that Act, or what is happening between the two acts? I just want to know your clarity. No, I'm not yet finished. So when you looked critically in the Foodstuffs and Cosmetic Act, you'd find two distinct definitions of a foodstuff and a cosmetic. Now, do you really have a problem with the current bill, with its last part in terms of the definition of a product? The very last part of it says a medicinal claim. Do you have a problem with that? Just try to clarify us on those confusions. Thanks.
Thank you, Honourable Member. If you give me a second, I quickly want to open up the draft food labelling regulation. Trying to say is that within the Department of Health, there are obviously various directorates. Now, the Directorate of Medicine, I think it's called Directorate of Medicine Control, have been set up to deal with medicines and the regulation thereof. And they fall under, they administer the Medicines and Related Substances Act. The Directorate of Food Control would deal with the Foodstuffs, Cosmetics and Disinfectants Act. Now, in terms of the Foodstuffs, Cosmetics and Disinfectants Act, that Directorate of Food Control has put forward these regulations, which go on for 77 pages, and took, as I say, have taken 6 years to draft. And there's a section there about health claims. Then further on down is enhanced function claims. And it says here, subject to the requirement of relevant regulations, etc., etc., so you have to be able to, before you can make a enhanced function claim on a foodstuff in terms of these regulations, you would have to be able to show that the efficacy, functionality of the nutrient, the food component, has been proven by meta-analysis of randomized control, human intervention studies, etc. So these regulations go into great detail as to when are you allowed to make a claim on a foodstuff and when you are not. If you now go and put the same issue of foodstuffs into the Medicines Related and Substances Act, you're going to have a different directorate who may have a, who won't have these regulations. They're going to have their own interpretation in terms of the the act of how do you actually enforce this medicinal claim issue. Now, I just don't want there to be confusion in the eyes of the public and within the department, and to lose all of this good work that's been done for the last 6 years to bring these important issues to a point that are literally at a point now where we hope the Department of Health will promulgate these regulations and they'll be in place at sometime in the very near future. And we don't actually want to go back from this now, because now we've got to debate a whole new set of regulations in terms of the Medicines and Related Substances Act and how these two now must interact. If you look, just to show you on further, on reduction of disease risk claims, Regulation 62. I'm assuming this is what one would consider to be medicinal claims. Some people would anyway. The following reduction of disease risk claims that link the consumption of food or food constituents in the context of the total diet to the reduced risk of developing a disease or health-related condition shall be permitted for foodstuffs. And then they say you can only say it for certain things. So if you've got calcium, then you can say it helps to reduce the risk of osteoporosis, etc., etc. I'm not going to read this whole boring, long regulation to you, but you can clearly see that a lot of time and effort has gone into this from the Directorate of Food Control. And I just think that it would be such a waste to now lose all of this and have it somehow taken up into another bill. And that is the point I'm trying to make. I mean, I suppose the Directorate of Food Control should actually be here saying this, but maybe that they can't. Thank you.
Thanks. As a follow-up, you've kind of helped us in another respect. You've just pointed out that it's taken 6 years for regulations to come about. We heard yesterday how many aspects of laws that we've passed 2, 3, any number of years ago have not been regulated. So people are carrying on in a confused environment. Here you have us. We're a bunch of cleanies and we want to actually get this done. You're talking to the legislature now, not people who you hope will do something because they've worked on it for a number of years. So here we are trying to sort out the problem. You're saying that, oh, all the work's been done, now you're trying to take it over. But we want to make it clear. So you've also shown us how you get to a point with the Food and Cosmetics Bill where it stops at a food. You can only call a thing a food up to this point. You can only call it a medicine or a whatever, a healing product, if you, and then you say, do meta-analyses, you do, I don't know what they are in the regulations, but you do a whole lot of tests. Who's going to manage those tests? This is where this bill comes in. So the two bills have got to talk to each other. That one stops at a food. This one takes up where you've got to prove that it has an additional claim. We do need them both. So I don't sort of see the rationale of your argument. You're saying it's all been done by the Food and Cosmetics Act, no need for you to do it, but they stop where you can't make claims unless you do all these things, and they can't regulate those things. So, and then one more question or one more point that I had to make to you, that definition that you gave us was great about a food, a medicinal claim, except that you said it must be able to be shown to treat a recognized medical condition. Oh, you're entering a lexicon of problems. You know, in every field of medicine, there's arguments about the definition of psychiatric disease, of the margin between compromised immune system and actual illness. So, over to you. You see how you can help us out of that one. Except that, as I say, the regulations, we could mandate that the regulations must relate. So we must take into account those regulations in adopting regulations in this legislation.
So, you know, the advantage of having Dr. Rabino with us, a doctor in this committee, is really helping. Yeah. I would want to say I'm covered by him.
So you're basically saying that the definition, the new definition, product, we should not be looking at that definition. We should be saying either medicines or food supplements, and we should leave out the definition as it appears here. I didn't pick that up in your presentation, but is that what you're effectively saying? that the new definition that they are suggesting, where medicines is now under an umbrella term of product and encompasses medicines, medical devices, foods, and cosmetics with medical claims.
Thank you very much, honorable members. Let me start with the last one first because it's possibly the easiest. As representing Pick and Pay, I didn't want to get into the field of possibly what the pharmaceutical manufacturers would be dealing with. So we tried to tamper as little as possible with the definitions, possibly by adding one more definition on medicinal claims. But of course, the other way to do it would be to unravel that definition of product and merely list those two or three items independently, as you rightly say, to say that this act relates to medicines, as it always did, leave that word in there, medical devices, depending on what your deliberations in that aspect go, and whatever else you want to add, just list them. But by trying to have one term product, what actually happens is you end up dragging things maybe like a foodstuff, which possibly there's some merit in regulating them under certain sections, into other sections where I can't see the merit of regulating them, merely because you're now stuck with this word product, which encompasses all of those terms. So to deal with Honorable Rabinowitz's question, in terms of the food labeling regulations, I don't want to waste our time paging through this document. It's quite bulky, and I didn't prepare on that particular point. But there is, in fact, a proposed procedure similar to an MCC-type procedure for checking the claims and approving them, so making sure that there's peer-reviewed scientific literature, et cetera, et cetera. So these regulations already have that in place. And again, to have the MRS now duplicate that, I don't understand how that can lead to greater efficiency. I'm absolutely honest, I don't know how the committee has influence on the Department of Health to pass regulations quicker. I would have thought that any act that gets passed, it's just a normal sequela that the regulations should follow quite quickly, but yet they don't seem to. So I would suggest that if we have these regulations and they're ready to roll, we should actually go with these ones that we're ready to roll and not risk that we will have another 4 years delay. When it comes to the definition of medicinal claims, it's a good point. You know, I actually put that word recognized medical condition, as you saw, I showed the Oxford Dictionary definition, which, by the way, assuming I have not put the definition in, that I think would be the definition that should be used in any event, because every word in a law should be given its normal meaning. So I put that definition in because otherwise it's going to lead to great uncertainty. Somebody makes some claim that they treat, I mean, that note that was circulated yesterday, what if you need success in court cases or something, I mean, people make all sorts of wild claims. I once had a bottle of homeopathic thing in my hand which claimed that it cured frigidity in women, and it cured all sorts of strange things, and it contained crushed ants arrhythmically shaken. Now, I'll never forget that label. Now, I wanted to draw a line between that and what I consider to be medicinal claims, since this is the Medical and Related Substances Bill. But sure, it's open for debate. I mean, one may want to just revert to let's call it the Oxford Dictionary type definition of medicinal claim. Thank you.
Any other youth members? Honorable Madela.
Thank you, Chair. Sir, you, in your written submission, you raise concerns with regard to the transitional provisions, and if you can just elaborate on it, because I, in my mind, thought that Section 43 indeed would cover these kind of concerns sufficiently. Perhaps you must bring to our attention some areas that you think that we may not have adequately, or that we should adequately consider, and perhaps expand on the transitional arrangements or provisions. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Honorable Member. excuse the delay, I just wanted to turn to the correct page. All we were raising there is it's to do with the fact that certain exemptions and leniencies have been granted in terms of the existing system. Now, the way I understand the transitional measures in Section 43 of the bill, they don't necessarily deal with these exemptions, etc. They deal more with if something has already been registered, it shall remain registered until somebody does. These are more to do with what the council does. What we are concerned about is once a council ceases to exist, the minister is given all these powers. Will these exemptions continue? You know, it leads to great uncertainty in the business. But this question was dealt with, I think, quite extensively yesterday by the Self-Medication Association. And to be honest, I really don't have anything to add to their argument.
Thank you very much. So, Pick and Pay sources, you run a number of pharmaceutical groups in your hypermarket, and the wholesalers supply you. You are supplied by the wholesalers into.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, but we must also remember what you say is correct. The wholesalers supply us with medicines. There would be certain products that Pick and Pay would source itself. Most likely there would be vitamins, supplements, those types of products. Now, those products may be sold in a Pick and Pay pharmacy, but they may also be sold just in a normal run-of-the-mill Pick and Pay supermarket on the shelf. So it's not necessarily only in the pharmacy. But from a medicines perspective, obviously the medicines have to be purchased through existing supply channels because, as far as I know, at this stage, Pick and Pay has not endeavored to try and get any medicines registered or to start some sort of distribution network yet. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Now, you see, I'm asking this question because we just want to follow up because the end result of Pick and Pay was able to open up the pharmacies or your cakes as a consequence of the same legislation as amended. That's why you were able to open up these pharmacies in your areas, your cliques, your PK, which were not normally allowed in the past as before the amended legislation had to come into effect. Now, you see, you are raising now, and I've looked at this list of the claims, and there was, and again, it's very good now you are making this critique of this 13 quick claims that are actually being made by people. It seems that members, maybe the department, maybe they start there, so I'll reverse my thinking. The PGP suggests that foodstuff is defined and there are certain processes. And there are certain things that govern the question of the foodstuff, and they actually go into detail, and they are currently busy with the regulation to deal with that particular aspect. And therefore, let's delink that particular foodstuff legislation to this current legislation that is actually dealing with. But there are certain concerns as raised by the members when they were raising certain questions, in particular the relationship and the consequent dangers that are there between the foodstuffs and the medicines and a lot of things that can go through the cracks, and there needs to be sort of an over-encompassing legislation that guards against these cracks. And especially South Africa with all these developed countries and with all these globalized activities taking place, you find our people become victims of some of these nefarious activities that take place from quasi people. How would you respond from this particular view from Pick and Pay, Department of Health?
Thank you, Chair. There will be cross linking with the regulations as cited. From the food side. The intention of this particular bill to bring in is to manage the things that could fall between the cracks and claims that are clearly directed at serious conditions. For instance, we do find now that there will be what is purported to be food sometimes, and people will make claims that it will cure AIDS and whatever and whatever. Now, these are serious claims that we wouldn't ordinarily want to bring out there without proper scrutiny of the evidence. And the intention is not to do away with the Foodstuffs Act and the control that is under that the Foodstuffs Directorate. If we look at the overarching body that we're looking at, there will be a division that deals with food regulation, and will be a division that deals with cosmetic regulation and medicines on its own. But with specific reference to the Medicines Act, that's the whole overarching regulatory authority. But if you look specifically at the Medicines Act, there are things that fall between the cracks that we can't define under the Foods Act that border on medicine. Even vitamins, beyond a certain level, you won't call a vitamin a vitamin. Beyond a certain level, there are certain dangers that we have to look into in terms of side effect profile, what we could do to you, which is higher than what you would ordinarily sell at a normal shop. So the intention here is to close that gap, if I may put it, is to close that gap where things fall between the cracks. And we've seen many examples, as Honorable Rabinovich says, we have seen many examples with very strange claims. So there will be cross-referencing when we do regulations and what is in the food regulations and what would be in these regulations to close those gaps. But the intention is not to regulate all food.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Look, the Department of Health will in any event be regulating this. So it's not that we're saying don't regulate it. Our real point is that this has gone so far already from the food control side to regulate it, and a lot of thought has gone into it, a lot of development work over the years. Food control also enforced, the enforcement angle is enforced on a municipal level already. So enforcement is everywhere over the whole country. Your local municipality enforces the food regulations. So from an enforcement angle, it's also much simpler to enforce rather than having a centralized enforcement from Tshwane. You know, I'm not saying it mustn't be regulated, and yes, the cracks must be closed, but I think one has to really carefully read through these regulations, and you will see that those cracks, if they exist, are really, really thin. And, you know, it's probably a lot simpler to just add to these existing regulations than to amend the bill and then to create new regulations in terms of that bill, and then to make sure that there's no conflicting overlap. Because it's one thing to have overlap, it's another one to have conflicting overlap. So that's really the proposal and the suggestion that we're making. And, of course, we're quite happy to work further with the Department of Health to try and close those gaps. You know, it's not in our interest to pick and pay, to have uncertainty. We want certainty in the market, and we obviously want safe products for clients. There's no doubt at all. That's why we're here. We're here really to see how we can help to try and get this matter to finality and improvement without causing confusion. Thank you.
Thanks, Jack. I think it's important also to to note that the regulations that I referred to are not regulations, they are draft regulations. And that was, I think, at the time, as far back as July 2007. Many of them have been overtaken by events, especially with regard to the task teams working to the political process, working to the bill. So obviously, as we proceed with the bill, there will be a process to ensure that there is no conflict between the two. One of the reasons why there's been a delay is because we're trying to make sure that we draw a clear line between the foodstuffs and the foodstuffs making medicinal claims, that the latter gets every terms of the bill as envisaged, and then the former in terms of the regulations that have been referred to. But it's a bit misleading to keep in mind that it's regulations from the department, that draft regulations, the trunk regulations at this point in time. But the department at any time, yep. No, but it kept on saying regulations, as if it's regulations that are enforced at the moment. Yeah. Yeah, so we are working on them. If there are any apparent conflicts between them and what is in the bill, that's what we'll be working on.
Chair, actually, I'm not on this one of the regulations. Okay.
You mentioned the body that regulates foods already is a local body. I'm just interested to know, for example, there is a product in fish. We're worried now about mercury in fish, and in certain supermarkets in America, there are big signs on the door, the equivalent of Pick n Pay supermarkets, and they say, we cannot guarantee that any fish coming from our fish store are free of mercury, and it's very harmful to pregnant women, to babies. Who monitors the levels of these toxic products in your fish, for example, that you sell from your fish stores? And is there anybody who does it? And who in local government knows what the products are? What laboratories do they use? Who pays for it? There's another chemical I heard about at a conference, and unfortunately I can't think of the name, which is ubiquitous. It's everywhere, and it's much more dangerous than mercury. And evidently all fish all over the world have to be monitored for this chemical. It's an odd name. I think to people who sell fish products, they would know the name of that chemical. Maybe somebody in the department will help us. With a chemical that is toxic in fish, and it's supposed to be monitored in fish all over the world before that fish is marketed by some supervisory body. So I just would like to know, how accountable are companies that sell products to consumers in terms of these toxic materials being monitored and controlled and condemned?
With foods, I think the department will be able to help us here. How are you going to monitor vegetables, fruits that cause some reaction to some kind of people? Myself, I can't take bread, I can't take tomato, I can't take oranges because it causes heartburn to me. And I can get ulcer at the end of the day from them. Now, how are you going to control that kind of foodstuff?
Okay, I'll just respond first to Honorable Member Rabinovitz. The short answer is the answer you won't like. No one's monitoring it except yourselves. In other words, Pick n Pay has a team of food technologists, and all foodstuffs that come through get monitored regularly. They do third-party audits through SANAS-approved laboratories, testing through SANAS-approved laboratories on all their suppliers. But these things do come out. I don't know if you'll recall, a while back there was a thing with the raised levels of cadmium in pineapples. You know, these things do come out, and then they get, you know, somebody picks it up, and then the market gets thrown into turmoil, because what do you do now? There's no more pineapples in the market. So they do actually pick these things up. Your fish question, I honestly don't know the answer to that. I can fish around for it, but I don't know. But I think the same situation applies even in the USA. I don't know if you remember this whole scandal with the fish that we imported from China, which had some toxins in them as well. And the reality is that it's almost impossible for any government department to monitor every single foodstuff that's sold on the market regularly. They can possibly ask for certification when it arrives from the supplier, but you can only possibly statistically test to see if they are complying with those requirements. It's not possible for everything to be tested. And there is a large degree of self-regulation in the food industry everywhere in the world. The bottom line is, you know, all a food retailer has is its reputation. And if you throw that away, that costs you big money, and then the market regulates you. I don't know if that answers your question, if it makes you feel any safer about what you eat, but that's the truth.
May I respond, Chair?
We know where we're going to. I think, in a way, I think somehow we all are beginning to understand that there must be some loopholes that are actually should be closed. There's a particular process of the foodstuff cosmetics and disinfectant legislation. There's a particular process we're dealing with here, and there's a legal person from the department. Those regulations are at a particular standstill, perhaps as
waiting to ensure that there's some form of an intersection of certain activities to take place to ensure that residents are actually addressed in this regard. And I think let's leave it there for now, but at least we have, it's really been very helpful around this particular thing for us. The main area now remaining, and it's not only Pick and Pay that has raised it, I think Discovery also raised it, is this aspect on the, that perhaps we just mentioned medicinal claim, we may need to define medicinal claim. And I think, let's correct our scars on that, there's a suggested definition from your Oxford dictionary that is suggested. Of course, sometimes it may never be quite useful to its logical conclusion when it comes to certain medical definitions, but there may be certain one or two operative words that may actually be used in that regard. But I think let's just crack our skulls around this particular question, whether this view about to define medicinal claim, what do we think about it? So that at least there's a sort of a benchmark that we're actually going to be using to move from. Do I make sense, Prof? This Mandy?
No, we agree. I think that we need to reflect and come up with something and avoid any turf wars either way for the benefit of the people of this country. But I think that even Pick and Pay in their presentation agree that there has to be regulation. I think there's no doubt about that. Secondly, I think there's a big difference between food, like an apple, and a supplement that has medicinal claims. There's two different things. And I think that we need to be able to divide these things. And I think that's what's coming up. Because if you put all together like apples and oranges and food supplements with medicinal claims, I think they're too heterogeneous, and some has to be on food side and some on other side. But I think that to what I'm talking is that this is a challenge globally, and the FDA has also been applying its mind to this. So I think what the chair is saying is correct, because the FDA is putting its mind on it, the UK is putting their mind on it, the Far East is putting its mind on it, and I think it's a critical issue. And I think that the more people are putting their minds to it, they are saying there are certain things that have to come under the regulatory authority. But there are other things like food that stay under food and not put everything under food. And I think we need to decide on that.
Thank you very much.
One, we've actually raised that one. We'll have to come back to that one, the question of the wholesalers and the single exit price. Some people raised that thing. We'll have to come back to those things. Was some people were saying there are certain fundamental tricks that are entered into around this, but you have really guided us. Thank you very much. Members, National Association of Pharmaceutical Wholesalers.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. No, I'm not. I am going to make use of a flip chart, though, Mr. Chairman, which is at the back over there. But when the time comes, we'll sort it out. Don't need to worry about that now.
Honorable Chairman and Honorable Members, thank you for the opportunity to address you. My name is Jaco Roestoff. I'm an attorney from Pretoria, and I represent the National Association of Pharmaceutical Wholesalers, the NAPW. The NAPW did submit written submissions to you, and I accept that you've read these. It is not my intention to go through these written submissions. First, we don't have the time, and I will probably bore you to death. But second, other associations have already addressed the bulk of the issues raised in those submissions. As such, I will focus on one aspect only, which is probably the most important aspect, which relates to the accessibility and affordability of medicines. This is, in any event, I submit, the underlying reason and the rationale for the proposed amendments to the Principal Act as proclaimed in the bill. Now, as proposed yesterday by the Honourable Dr. Abinovitz, I will not merely read from my submissions in this regard. Instead, I will try and summarise what we've said in our written submissions in my oral presentation to you, and I will try and highlight the critical aspects of the arguments raised in the written submissions. For the record, however, you will find the detail of my submissions, what I'm about to address to you now, under the headings Legislative Gaps and Section 22G. Those are the issues that I will be focusing on. The bill proposes only one amendment to Section 22G of the Principal Act, and that is that the word medicine be replaced by the word product. We say that this amendment is not enough. There should be a further amendment. The bill should go further to amend Section 22G, and in the particular, the provisions of Section 22G(2c). We submit, if this does not happen, government will not succeed in its stated objective of making medicines more accessible and more affordable to all South Africans on a sustainable basis. What we ask is that Section 22G(2c) be deleted and be replaced. We suggest the wording, and at the end of my presentation, Honourable Chairman, I will ask your indulgence to present each of the members of the Portfolio Committee with a document containing the suggested wording, how we say Section 22G(2c) should read. In order to motivate my suggested amendments, I will seek your indulgence to delve into some detail. I'm afraid I have to do so in order to explain properly what we are trying to say to you. Now, Section 22G, as you would know, of the Principal Act, deals with the critical aspect of the pricing of medicines. That is what this is about, making medicines more accessible and making medicines cheaper to the benefit of all South Africans. Section 22G actually allows the Honourable Minister to make regulations on three aspects. First, a transparent pricing system for all medicines, which the Minister did through the introduction of a so-called single exit price, the SEP. Second, on appropriate, and I emphasise the word appropriate, remuneration for wholesalers and distributors, which the Minister sought to do through the introduction of logistics fees for logistical services by logistics providers. And third, on appropriate remuneration for the dispensers of medicines, pharmacists and dispensing doctors, I refer to them as retailers, which the Minister also sought to do through the introduction of a dispensing fee which is added to the SEP. Now, unfortunately, like my predecessors before me, or unlike my predecessors before me, I'm not an IT boffin, so I will not show you a PowerPoint presentation. I don't know how these things work, and I can't explain myself properly through a PowerPoint presentation. I have, however, prepared a flip chart, and with your indulgence, Honourable Chairman, I would like to make use of the flip chart in explaining what I have to say. I will get to the flip chart shortly. I just want to make the point that because Section 22G(2c) is inappropriately worded, the pricing regulations promulgated by the Honourable Minister in terms of Section 22G are defective. So the pricing regulations, as far as they concern the issue of logistics and logistics fees and logistical service providers, those pricing regulations are defective. And the reason for that is because the act we submit is not properly worded. And because one cannot put the cart in front of the horse, Section 2c needs to be remedied so as to ensure that the pricing regulations are remedied in turn. I will now turn to the presentation over there.
Format,
shippers and wrappers and caseloads and what have you on a flatbed truck that are delivered at the wholesaler. It's a relatively inexpensive function to move the product from the manufacturer to the wholesaler. It's, because of the bulk involved, a relative infrequent action to deliver the product from the manufacturer to the wholesaler. However, once the wholesaler receives the product, then starts the fun. He must now unpack the bulk, he must check it, he must control it, he must then shell the product that he's purchased, some 18,000 products from 500 manufacturers. He then takes orders from some 3,000 retailers down here. He then picks and packs the orders. He then invoices, and he then delivers in his little bucket to each and every pharmacy throughout the country, more than once per day. So you can appreciate that the two functions are totally different. And besides the two functions being totally different, bulk distribution is to the benefit of the manufacturer upstream. Fine distribution is to the benefit of the retailer downstream. However, the pricing regulations, unfortunately, define both these functions as logistical services. There's not a differentiation between the two services, which is vital. Which takes me to my third chart. And that is the single exit price and how the single exit price is made up. Now, the single exit price, ladies and gentlemen, honorable members, is the price that applies throughout the entire supply chain. It's a regulated price. It's a fixed price. If the single exit price of a specific medicine is, for example, 114 Rand, that is the price at which this medicine will be sold from the manufacturer to the wholesaler, to the retailer, to the patient. One price for the medicine. That's what we call a regulated price. It's regulated. And it consists of three components. The first component is the manufacturer net price. That is there to compensate the manufacturer. Out of this, the manufacturer must recover its overhead, and the manufacturer must earn a reasonable profit. Added to that is the logistics fee component. The logistics fee component is supposed to compensate the logistical service provider for the provision of logistics or logistical services. In other words, to compensate distributors and wholesalers for bulk and fine distribution. That's the second component. No one else is supposed to share in this component. And the third component is that, and that's obviously the bit that goes to government. And these three components, then, if you add them together, will give you the single exit price. So by means of an example, the manufacturer has determined the manufacturer net price at 90 Rand. The logistics fee component is negotiated to 10 Rand. We'll get to that shortly. That adds up to 100 Rand. That on that would be fixed at 14%, so it's 14 Rand. The single exit price for the product, therefore, is 114 Rand. It sounds simple, but it's not. Because you see, this price is regulated. The single exit price is a regulated price. And effectively, the manufacturer net price is also regulated. Because albeit that the manufacturer can determine its own net price, it's subject to, for example, international benchmarking. That's what government can control the price. The same applies to that. I mean, that is set at 14%. But the pricing regulations, funnily enough, say that the logistics fee component must be negotiated. That's not regulated, it's negotiated. Between who? Between the manufacturer upstream and the logistical service provider, i.e. the wholesaler and the distributor in the middle. But all the services, logistical services, are not performed upstream for manufacturers. Only bulk distribution is to the benefit of the manufacturer. Downstream, it's to the benefit of the retailer and ultimately the patient. So why then is the retailer not involved in this negotiation process? And because of this, the manufacturers are in a much stronger position than the logistical service provider in the negotiation process. And the problem with that is, the manufacturers actually determine what this logistics fee component is. Because you see, it has to be negotiated with each and every logistical service provider. Which brings us to a very complex and complicated issue. For example, you know now that there are about 20 genuine wholesalers operating throughout the country. But for example, a manufacturer negotiates with wholesaler A and with wholesaler B. With wholesaler A, it negotiates a logistics fee of 10 rand. So the single exit price would be 90 plus 10 plus 14 equals 114. But with wholesaler B, it negotiates a logistics fee of 5 rand. So actually, the single exit price would then be 90 plus 5, that's 95, 14% on that is 13 rand 30, how's that for math? And that equals 108 rand 30. I wrote it down in pencil, just by the way. But effectively then, you would have two single exit prices. But we know that we can only have one single exit price. So what happens? The manufacturers say, I've determined my logistics fee component, unilaterally by the way, at 10 rand. I've negotiated with wholesaler B a fee of 5 rand. So what happens? There's 5 rand in the pool, in the hands of the manufacturer. What does the manufacturer do with this? He puts it in his pocket. In other words, he either will profiteer illegally from the logistics fee component, or he's got 5 rand in the kitty with which he can play. And how does he play? He incentivizes retailers to dispense his products because he's got 5 rand to do it. And how does he do that? He says to the retailer, in terms of section 18A, I'm sorry, I may not give you a discount because I may not incentivize you. But I'll tell you what, you register as a wholesaler and I will pay you a logistics fee of 5 rand. Nothing but a discount. It's a guy's logistics fee. It's a guy's discount. That is why, ladies and gentlemen, honorable members, we have 500 registered wholesalers in South Africa. The patient doesn't get the benefit of this. So the obvious problem is, this is not regulated properly because it's not fixed. And as long as it's not fixed, you will have fooling around with the logistics fee component. And that, besides the perversities in the supply chain, unfortunately results therein that wholesalers do not earn their appropriate remuneration. So if we go further then with the single exit price, it is then sold, as I said, to the retailer at the same price, the single exit price. He then adds his dispensing fee, which is supposed to be his remuneration. In our example, it would be 26 rand. So he would then sell to the patient at 140 rand. It's 140 rand plus the dispensing fee. The only add-on to the SEP is the dispensing fee of the retailer. Which takes us to our next chart. And that's the product flow versus the money flow. Now the product flow is easy. The product flow is from the manufacturer to the wholesaler, to the retailer, to the patient. Simple. The money flow is a bit more complicated. Because the manufacturer sells the product to the wholesaler. The wholesaler immediately pays him. But what does the wholesaler pay the manufacturer? He pays the manufacturer the total SEP. Not only the manufacturer net price. So the manufacturer gets, when he sells the product, his portion plus the logistics fee plus the VAT. And the poor old wholesaler must sell it 114 rand to the retailer, and he must now raise an invoice to the manufacturer for payment of the logistics fee, which he's paid in the first instance, and which is recovered from the patient ultimately downstream. But fact of the matter is, and what I want you to understand, is that the manufacturer, albeit that he pays the logistics fee, it's not out of his pocket, because he gets it before he pays it. It's ultimately the patient that pays for it. So why then must the manufacturer have the right to unilaterally determine the logistics fees, as is happening in the marketplace? That's wrong. But in South Africa, our model is a bit more complicated, because it's not only wholesale. We have also distributors. Now remember that distributors are the agents for the manufacturers. In other words, the manufacturers
in the past delivered their products directly to the wholesaler themselves, the manufacturers at their own warehouses, and the wholesalers would then take it into their fine distribution warehouse, and they would then on-sell it to the retailers, bulk distribution, fine distribution. But the manufacturers, with reason, decided, look, this is a costly affair. We can't warehouse these products ourselves. We want distributors to do the warehousing for us and do the distribution for us as agents. Okay. So, the distributor was created. Now the products go to the wholesaler in one of two ways. The manufacturers who have their own finished warehouses deliver to the wholesalers directly, or the manufacturers make use of the distributors who warehouse on their behalf to get the products to the retail, to the wholesaler rather. That's quite simple and that's easy. That's the bulk distribution bit. And that's straightforward, and there's nothing wrong with an agency model. Absolutely nothing. But unfortunately, or maybe fortunately, the manufacturers also use the distributors to engage in fine distribution. In other words, the manufacturers sell directly to the retail market. They bypass the wholesaler. And in order to do this, they also use the distributor. Nothing wrong with that either, as long as both parties are compensated appropriately for the functions that they perform. Now, you will probably ask me, why, if the manufacturer can get his product to the retail market through the distributor, is the wholesaler necessary? And that would be a very clever question. And if I give you a clever answer, we will be here for the next 2 months, I promise you. But I will limit it to two issues, and only 2 points why the wholesalers are necessary. First and foremost, where the manufacturer makes use of the agent to get the product into the retail market, the manufacturer retains ownership of these products until sold at retail level. Now we're talking hundreds of thousands of products worth hundreds of thousands of rands here. The manufacturer never transfers the risk because he never transfers the ownership in between. And for that reason, only the wealthy manufacturers who have the necessary cash flow, who can afford to carry the stock and carry the risk, can make use of distributors. That means, out of the 500 or so manufacturers or suppliers in South Africa, approximately 40 make use of distributors for fine distribution to the retail market. The small manufacturer, the local manufacturer, the generic manufacturer, those guys who supply the cheap drugs that we're all seeking for, in order to get medicines as cheap as possible for the people, they can't afford to make use of distributors. They need the cash. They need to make the sale to the wholesaler so that the wholesaler now sits with their problem and does the sale to the 3,000 retailers out there. It's easier to sell to 20 in bulk than it is to sell to 3,000 in fine. I mean, it doesn't take a brain scientist to realize that. So what I'm saying to you is, if the wholesalers are not there, these manufacturers who supply the cheap drugs won't have wholesalers to sell their products to. They will fall by the wayside and you will not have your cheap medicines. Simple as that. And this is proved all over the world. That's from an upstream perspective. From a downstream perspective, it's just as simple. The retailer, there are, I think, 3 or 4 distributors in South Africa, 50 manufacturers. Now, can you imagine 500 manufacturers would then, if my sons are right, lead to approximately 40 distributors out there? Now, let's assume the wholesaler is not there. What happens now? The retailer must now place orders with not one entity, but 40 orders. Now you go ask any retailer what that does to his cost. You're not duplicating it, you're not triplicating it, you're not quadruplicating it, what, 40 times? Whatever it is, you're doing that. And that adds to the cost of medicine. Simple as that. Because the wholesalers, stock 18,000 lines, the genuine wholesalers. They stock 18,000 lines supplied by 500 manufacturers so that they could provide a one-stop shop to the retailer. And they have to do that in order to remain competitive because they can't compete on price, remembering that we are in a regulated environment. So it's now service that matters. One-stop shop is cheap. So, the flaws.
with the provisions of Section 22G2C, are two fundamental flaws. The first one is there's no differentiation between bulk and fine distribution. Both are defined as logistical service. The second one is there's no differentiation between wholesalers and distributors. Both are defined as logistical service providers. And the third issue is this logistics fee component is being manipulated in the marketplace. People are profiteering from it who aren't supposed to be profiteering from it. People are being incentivized who aren't supposed to be incentivized from it because the logistics fee component is not fixed. And to cap it is not going to help. Cap means to put a maximum fee. Because if you put a maximum fee, there's still latitude. I can still play around. You must fix it because then no one can play around. It's simple. So the solution we say, honorable members of the pricing committee, is to firstly fix the logistics fee component. And that could be done by the pricing committee. No one wants to make money out of it. The pricing committee is properly qualified. They have the necessary expertise. Let them determine a logistics fee. And they will determine it by, first of all, determining a logistics fee for bulk distribution and a logistics fee for fine distribution. Add the two together and hoorah, you have your fixed logistics fee. And the second issue is differentiate between bulk and fine distribution and differentiate between wholesalers and distributors, and that would require proper definitions. And that, in essence, is my flip chart presentation to you. I did say to you that I did prepare a two-page document, Honourable Chairman, with your permission, if I may hand out to the members a copy of this, where I do give the proposed wording, how we say Section 22G2C, or C, should read, in order to make the pricing regulations work. Again, you cannot put the cart in front of the horses, so we need to fix the act. And simply, we say Section 22G2C should read as follows: on a reasonable and appropriate logistics fee to be paid for the provision of logistical functions, which fee shall... Which fee shall, one, differentiate between bulk distribution and fine distribution, two, differentiate between wholesalers and distributors, and three, be fixed for wholesalers in relation to fine distribution. And that's it, ladies and gentlemen, honourable members. That's the simple amendment that we're seeking. In order to give effect to this, there would probably have to be included certain definitions for wholesalers, distributors, logistical services, logistics fees, bulk distribution and fine distribution, and we do also give a proposed wording for such definitions. Obviously, we understand and we appreciate that everything that needs to be finalized, if it needs to be finalized, would have to be in conjunction with the honorable members and or the Department of Health, and we are 100% willing to cooperate where necessary. And that concludes my presentation. I thank you.
Thank you very much, sir, for your presentation. Kept everybody awake. They're animated because you brought quite a creative angle to some of the issues you want to raise. And, okay. I thought that the department wants to raise them before I say anything. Thank you very much. Hadley.
Chair, I don't think it is proper. I don't really think it's procedural for the department to start before us, actually. I don't think it's proper.
No, fine. No, I was. I just scanned through the side of the honorable member, but he didn't see the end. So I thought you were still digesting my humble and sincere apologies. Please don't lynch the chair, please. He needs all your protection for the day. Honorable Chair.
Thank you, Chair. I'm going to refer to the flip chart.
I want to check whether the distributors have a right to jump the wholesaler and sell straight to a retailer. That's point number one. Number two is whether the distributor pay logistics fee. I have other questions, but I want to get clarity on those.
May I, Honourable Chair?
Sorry, Chair, the last one is whether, because you started by saying the manufacturers, the cost is expensive. I want to check whether, because according to what you've given us, your flip chart, the bulk of the work is done by wholesalers, because the labeling is done by the wholesalers. Whether the distributors also do the labeling. Thank you.
Honourable Chairman, I think I would like to respond to these questions. Maybe it gets a bit too much. To get to the first question, maybe I should just qualify this by saying, if I've created the impression that the NIPW is against either manufacturers or distributors, it's not the case. It's a practical issue which we're dealing with here. Yes, distributors also distribute products directly to the retail market in bypassing wholesalers. And that is our main concern. Because the less products received by the wholesaler, the more his costs would become. The more expensive he would become to do distribution for a small generic company or a cheap local company, driving up the price of medicines. In order for a wholesaler to be effective, it needs to distribute all the products in competition with the distributor, but he must have access thereto. What is currently happening because of this negotiation process is that certain manufacturers are refusing to pay wholesalers a fee. So the wholesalers are stocking these products and they distribute them in order to provide the one-stop-shop service to their customers without a fee. So it's being abused. But yes, the distributors also do fine distribution. Secondly, distributors also receive a fee for the fine distribution that they perform. And that, in fact, is provided for in the pricing regulations. Because logically, honourable member, if you act as my agent, it's my responsibility, it's still my responsibility to get my product to the market where I want to send it. So it's my choice to appoint you as a distributor and to agree a fee with you which I will pay you. That's fine, because you're my agent. But you see, the situation changes completely when I make a sale to the wholesaler. And he then on-sells to the retail market. Because the wholesaler, the manufacturer, then falls completely out of the picture. And that's the difference between the two. The one taking ownership and the one remaining as an agent. And I cannot remember the third question.
It was around the labeling. I think
yes. Yeah, obviously, where they do find distribution, it would be more or less the same labor intensity. Bearing in mind, however, that the distributors normally only do distribution for 15 or 20 manufacturing companies. So it's a much smaller volume of product, and ironically, the much more expensive product. So it's the old issue of low volume, high value. Whereas the wholesalers, they carry all the products. It's low value product, high volume. So effectively, the wholesaler would do more work, yes.
Thank you, Chairperson. From listening to your presentation, what I deduced is that at the end of the chain, it is the patient that suffers. I want to know the existence of these distributors, because according to my little knowledge, we've been having wholesalers from the time I was, I think, born, or even before I was born. When did these distributors come into play?
I remember the first distributor in South Africa was created, I think, in 1993, when four manufacturers got together and formed their own distributor. At that point in time, the distributor was owned by the manufacturer. And it was an obvious ploy by the manufacturers to gain control, we say, over the retail market. We challenged them legally through the courts. That ended in the manufacturers divesting from the distributors. So the distributors at this point in time are independent parties. And again, if I created the impression that we're anti-distributor, we're not. They have a function to fulfill, and we appreciate that. All that we are saying as wholesalers is allow us to compete on an equal footing to the benefit of the patient. That's all.
So I just want to confine myself to this 22G thing, because initially it isn't the primary act. Now, I just want to know, so that we can find peace between the current bill and the primary act, do you suggest that this clause, this section, must be revoked in the current bill, or what are you suggesting? And second to that, you have made mention of the manner in which regulation is differing from this point to this point. Could you further clarify as to what actually the pricing committee, which is located within the Department of Health, is dealing with the whole thing right now? Thank you.
Yes, Honourable Member, to get to the last aspect, we have been in communication with the Department of Health and accordingly indirectly the pricing committee with us for the past few years. We are in regular discussion with them, and we have a wonderful relationship with them. Unfortunately, we accept these things do take time, but we see the problem. Remember, the regulations would be a subordinate form of legislation. In other words, you cannot use a regulation to interpret an act. And we say that the regulations are faulty because the act, in the first instance, is faulty. And that is why we are here today and we did the submissions. The bill is set to amend the Principal Act. So while the bill is set to amend the Principal Act, now is also the opportunity to remedy this issue. Remedy the Principal Act. Once the Principal Act is remedied, the regulations out of necessity will have to be remedied in order to provide for what we have said. And that is what we are asking you.
Thank you, Chair. I think the last comment is in actual fact to an extent is dealing with my concern, because by and large the essence of your presentation actually deals with regulations that are not in front of us at the moment. What I think you sought to do is to amend, as you indicate, 22G, and I think you said small c, that does not provide for a retailer. It speaks of a distributor and a wholesaler, and not a retailer. This is what I gather you are aiming at. But what I'm failing to understand is, or to comprehend, is whether what you have put in front of us, whether that at the end will indeed be in the interest of the patient, that the patient will be charged a more affordable fee. You see, I don't see that at all. I rather see a situation of where the distributor, you indeed say you are not against it, but essentially it means that it would be better if there's no distributor. That is the sense I do get, that the supply chain should be the manufacturer and then the wholesaler and the retailer. You see, that the distributor that is there should not be there. That is the sense that I do get. But I do not get a sense, even if we take out the distributor, that the price paid by the patient at the end will be much cheaper than where a distributor is in the occasion. I didn't get that sense, Chair. Thank you.
Thanks, Chair, because I've got a related question. I just would like to know, the very critical point is that the payment channel does not follow the distribution channel. For me, that is the issue that is the most complicated. Because you said the wholesaler has to pay the manufacturer the full price of the medicine, which is his cost plus the allowed profit that he's just been approved, plus that. And that then is paid by the patient to the pharmacist. Now, if it ties up with what has just been asked, if you change it to what you recommend, will the wholesaler pay less to the manufacturer, and will the patient pay the same amount to the wholesaler? I mean, you'll add on a fixed amount that the wholesaler pays to the manufacturer, and then add on another fixed amount for small distribution that the retailer pays the wholesaler, or that the patient pays for the medicine, in other words, because the retailer is now going to add his service fee. It just goes to show that when you regulate medicines, you've got to be something close to an actuarial scientist. And really, thank you for making the complicated issue very clear for us. But can you help us understand that? Why does the money chain not correspond with the distribution chain? And how will your amendments cope with that?
Yes, thank you, honorable members. Let me try and respond to the last question first. We are not saying that the single exit price, the computation of the single exit price, should change in any way, manner or format. That's fine. What we do say is that the one component, the logistics fee component thereof, should not be open for negotiation, because that's where the abuse comes in. What we're saying is that should be fixed. And in fixing that component, provision should be made for bulk distribution and fine distribution, and also for distributors versus wholesalers, depending on who does the work. It is just to ensure that the people who perform the functions are being remunerated for the functions. Nothing more, nothing less. So to get to the second question, there will not be a direct benefit in price, because it's going to be the same, except that it's now going to be fixed. So yes, it may in certain circumstances be cheaper, the end price to the patient, because bear in mind that the logistics fee at this point in time is a component. This is set by the manufacturer at this point in time for all practical and intent purposes. We've heard rumors that manufacturers abuse this, certain manufacturers, again, I mean, I'm not generalizing here, by determining huge logistics fee components. That, however, since the department started to address this issue, has come down. But there's still a fluctuation. I mean, in certain instances, it's 15% maybe, the logistics fee component, and in others, it's 10. So, you know, there may be a saving for the patient ultimately there. That's not about the wholesaler or the distributor. That doesn't make a difference. But, and I think, with all due respect, this is, honorable member, what you need to understand. If the wholesaler is not compensated for his services, he will fall by the wayside. If the wholesaler falls by the wayside, the majority of manufacturers, the manufacturers who supply the cheap drugs, will also fall by the wayside. And that would have a devastating impact on patients. Because only the rich companies who can afford distributors would still be in business. And the rich companies obviously are those companies with the higher priced medicines. So yes, the blow to patients ultimately would be devastating. You also asked the question, is the distributor necessary if we say that the wholesaler is not, you know, if we say that the wholesaler is necessary? And we don't have a problem with the distributor at all. In fact, the more the merrier, the more competition, the better ultimately you'll have your services. But fact of the matter is, allow the participants in the supply chain to do what they are supposed to do and remunerate them. We are now dealing with a regulated issue, a regulated price, a fixed price. One component thereof is supposed to compensate wholesalers and distributors. Because of a badly worded act, with all due respect, and badly worded regulations, with all due respect, the wholesalers are not getting what they're entitled to. And we are saying, it's time that we all take note of this, because if the wholesalers aren't there, the people out there are going to suffer. And I'm afraid, it is logical, I submit. I mean, I don't even have to go further on this point.
point of order to raise with you, Chairperson. I need clarity, also via the Parliament's law advisor. The section is a wonderful presentation and it's a wonderful debate, but I'm just wondering, is this just academic or not? Because the bill in front of us does not seek to amend Section 22G. Now, you are bringing in a new amendment, sir, and as much merit as it has, I don't know whether this committee has the authority to, we can entertain your submission and listen to you, but it's not in the bill before us. So, Chairperson, I'm seeking clarity on this point of order. You know, the amendment proposed is not in the bill before us. Please, let's be guided before we dwell further on the matter.
I was wanting guidance from yourself. But you see, the worry I have is that it's a new point. It's not in the amendments. We all agree. But the way I have listened, it brings into play, I think you said certain gaps in the regulation or something like that, and fundamental gaps with a particular impact, or let's say a severe impact to the patient slash consumer. That's why perhaps, maybe you are right, but how would, I don't want this thing to slip through the cracks and we leave it and then the scenario they have presented continues ad infinitum. In the process, the patient gets affected. How do we deal with that one? It's either, again, I think we ourselves, I think it's a point most of us have been raising, that these regulations, we should have at least had a very careful monitoring of the process. I would suggest that, but it's something we can't just leave. It's quite a very serious matter that is being raised by NAPW. NAPW, am I right? National Association of Pharmaceutical Wholesalers. Now, I think we just need a way forward there, and maybe at some point we'll have to come back, either to call the department, and they tell us, because it says the minister must do this thing in terms of these regulations on appropriate fees, in terms of wholesalers, distributors, and then the bill also mentions, or any other person. What does that mean? We don't know. So we'll have to come back and deal with this particular issue. I don't know if you will agree with us.
Honorable Chairman, absolutely. I will not respond. I think there is a way. There is an amendment to Section 22G. There is an amendment proposed in the bill, so why can't that amendment be made further? Just point me that bill. The word product is, or the word medicine is being replaced by product, so there is an amendment to 22G. All that we're submitting... Yes, I will get it. I will get the bill.
And we have amendment of Section 22F, amendment of Section 22H. It's a consequential amendment in terms of the word, I understand that. Page 13, I looked there to see, and then of the amendment bills, right? So I don't see 22G listed in here.
I apologize, yes. 22G specifically is not here. 22H is the section that relates to wholesalers. I have sympathy with the issue raised, Honorable Chairman, but it is a pressing issue and it is an urgent issue, as you quite correctly said. From our perspective, all that I can say is that we are willing to cooperate with who or what in order to fix this problem. And the request would accordingly be that the department and possibly the members, to the extent that they can assist, seek to address this issue, and again, we will commit ourselves to assist wherever we can.
I think you are right, we'll have to see, but let's just find a mechanism. You want to suggest something?
No, Chair, just with regard to the point of order, in terms of the MA rules, 249.3A says the committee must inquire into the subject of the bill and report on it to the Assembly. But in terms of B, if it is a bill amending provisions of legislation, it may seek the permission of the Assembly to inquire into amending other provisions of that legislation. So you can deal with 22G if it's approved by the Assembly, first chair.
But I can't allow you, you know the rules of Parliament. I did indicate to you, sir, Mr. Rene Dom, I can't allow you to speak. You are not part of the NAPW delegation. Is it part of the delegation? Because you may end up contradicting what they say and all those things, and you may actually create a problem for me. I can't allow you, sir. No, you can talk to them privately, that's fine. But you can't talk to me privately when I'm actually presiding over a meeting. That would be quite an odd situation presenting me with. So I think I think let's just agree there must be a process. The department has listened to yourself, and I think you must actually even find a mechanism of alerting us as a department, and we must in a way so that even the regulations, well, this thing you may not need necessarily a legislative amendment, but the regulation must now be alert to the implementation aspect and some of those issues that are shocking you were raising in the, what do you call the thing? Flip chart, thank you, in the flip chart. Can we agree with that? Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Manara Pukaria. Summer. Sure, it's Chris. No, but you can't ask questions when you close the discussion now. Summer. I'm sure you'll agree with me. I'm so sorry. I'm sure you, normally your hand is very clear, and my sincere apologies, sir. Thank you very much. Okay, please. Summer. Do you have a document to submit to us?
Thank you. And he was modified to his team. And he was correct, he was not in the bill, therefore basically you don't have a right.
And he was taking his communion,
because this is the first step to the
discussion.
Yeah,
this is
the
first step to the discussion.
African Medical Association. Thank you very much. Close the door, please. Back to you.
Thank you, Honorable Chairman, Honorable Members. I represent the South African Medical Association. My name is Ralph Kirsch, and I'm assisted by Dr. Bomela and by Mr. Buerta. The South African Medical Association is a professional association for doctors, and we welcome the opportunity to comment on this bill. We invited comment from all of our standing committees as well as from other interested parties in our membership, and these include some members of the present Medicine Control Council, so we have considerable insight through them. We would like to say that we support all legislative measures aimed at accentuating the protection and promotion of public interest and public health, and we support all measures designed at promoting access to health care. We have submitted a narrative, and it includes a number of technical issues which we wish to draw to your attention, but not in our verbal presentation. We'd like to, in fact, emphasize a couple of critical matters because we're aware of your time constraints. Now, the bill seeks to introduce an authority which will deal with certification and registration. I've used the broad category medicines. The authority represents, in our opinion, a significant improvement on the current system, and it will reduce delays in the registration of medicines and in approving vital trials. It will reduce these delays significantly, but without decreasing the high standards required for approval. And we strongly support this. Sorry, I need to go back. We also support, if we can go back, the authority is headed, next one, by the Chief Executive Officer, who is accountable and reports to the Minister. The CEO is appointed by the Minister, and again, we support this. The Minister has direct control over the authority and has the final say whether a product is registered or certified. And here we would like to indicate that we're concerned with the direct control that will now be conferred on the Minister in respect to the registration and certification of medicines, cosmetics, and medical devices and foodstuffs. We have the view that the authority will more than adequately fulfill this function in respect of medicines, and to confer this responsibility effectively on the Minister is imprudent and allows most respectfully to submit the reasons why. We believe the Minister is already putting a process in place which is both authoritative and safe and highly efficient.
much more efficient than in the past. In the past, the problem was not with the standard of the Medicine Control Council. It had a very high standard by international or any kind of judgment. It was superb. The problem was that there were long delays, sometimes at the cost to the end user, the patient. And the current system, the proposed system, is infinitely better in that regard. I'll come back to that if I may. The minister will be appointing the CEO on the basis of his or her knowledge, experience, and expertise. And that person will represent the minister and will constantly, I suspect, consult with the minister, especially where there's an issue which the minister should, in fact, give advice to. We also believe that the minister does not necessarily have the expertise and should not have the expertise. You can't be an expert in everything, and the issues in South Africa are now of such a pressing nature that the minister's major concern, particularly post-Polokwane, is to in fact implement a national system which will allow access of all to health care. Finally, is we believe that the minister would provide generic advice via the CEO, but not micromanage the process. The minister has really not got time. And we believe that this will in fact sit on a desk, and the minister, to have to sign off every one of these medicines, is going to delay a process which he seeks with a bill and achieves with a bill to speed up. So we have a major problem for those reasons with the minister having to apply her mind to every single legislation. We believe that she has structures in place which she's responsible for. She, after all, appoints the experts. She, after all, appoints the manager of the experts. And she, after all, has set the ground rules. And for her to now have to waste her time to sign off every medication, which can influence the process via her CEO and via the ground rules that she sets, we think is counterproductive. So we would like to most humbly express that reservation and to express to you, Mr. Chairman, to the honourable members, our thanks for the opportunity to present this.
Thank you very much, Mr. Cash, Mr. Monena. Submission member, get a submission. Short comment.
The chairman, I'm going to raise a question around what has been raised yesterday for many times about the two-tier system. The certification at the same time the registration. What you are raising in the presentation is the fact that the body should be solely independent. Its independence should not be diluted to or by another person, in essence. Now, I just want to know, what are your problematic areas about the minister registering a medicine at the end of the day?
I don't have any problem about the independence because we're in a democracy. The government is elected by the people. The government is responsible to the people. If the people are not happy, they will vote in another government. So the minister is not from a group of people who are unrepresentative. She represents the people, and in appointing a group of experts, she has the right to do so. But once she's appointed a group of experts, that group of experts apply the expertise, the knowledge to the problem. They can, if there are political overtones to the problem, for example, the choice between two critical areas, the issue of whether some drug will form part of the prescribed minimum benefits, which we will be using in a national insurance system. that kind of issue can be consulted with the minister, and the minister is there to do that. And we have that problem. It's not about independence, it's about effectiveness. Now, the minister has the right to choose these very expert people. She appoints them because they are experts. They clearly must be more expert than the minister in that field. Not overall, but in that particular field. Once she has appointed them and she's appointed the manager, we have a system which is accountable to the minister. But we don't need the minister to sign off that tetracycline should be available for sheep. I mean, I think that would be a total abuse of the minister's time. And what we have here is a very good bill. But the one issue that to me jars is that, and the minister's only human, the minister will have a pile of papers on her desk. She'll be running around the country as most ministers have to do. She'll be doing 101 other things. This is not going to be a top priority. And the paper will get bigger and bigger, and eventually somebody will walk in and say, "Minister, you've got to sign these." And she'll sign them without applying her mind. I'm arguing on behalf of some that we, in fact, have a legitimate government, a legitimate minister. She has a legitimate bill. She'll appoint a legitimate group of experts. Let them do the work. Let them be accountable to the minister. But don't make the minister sign every piece of paper. And that, to me, is a fundamental problem, which is not about any minister or any government or any... It's simply about efficiency.
Sir, I'm really wasting time because I know that most of the issues that the gentleman has raised were raised yesterday. And I think he has covered me because my question was around the power of the minister.
He has the power because she's appointed the expert, she's appointed the manager. The only thing is, will she have to sign every piece of paper? And our appeal is that she has the power, she can exercise that power, but there are better ways than having a pile of paper for her to deal with. And as it stands, that pile of paper will be there.
You're not going to make a presentation. I don't know where they
get.
Directly in the sense that
in fact have the confidence that such technicalities will be dealt with at that level without the need for intervention on the part of the office.
Members, I think I suggest we leave this presentation here, how to make a certain protocol, because the gist of what you say, we agree, but that would have caused an official to look at it. I would have thought, now in the details of the case, I mean,
I need to charge or see from the cold drop with my battery and flag. How far do I need to be? So if I feel good, I need to charge the time and ask the phone.
Thank you.
2004, within that group, it was rumored that that they were contemplating incorporating food into that structure, or at least the control of health claims. And since then, since 2004, we've heard nothing within that grouping regarding that. The other point that's related to that is then, of course, as was shown earlier this morning, the draft regulations which deal with health claims that were published in 2007. The point there is that it does seem as if there is really not very good communication within the Department of Health, where we do have these two sets of legislation that do complement one another in most ways, yet somehow also, from where I'm sitting, it almost seems that there might be some sort of competition for control. I do not understand it, and I might be totally wrong. But it doesn't seem that people are talking to one another. And I think that may be one of our concerns, because we do see really great things in both sets of published draft regulations. This I took from the Ministerial Task Team report, and in the acknowledgement, it gives some kind of an indication of the groupings of people who were consulted, and it's very much sort of biased towards the pharma industry and medicines and so on and so on. So I do see that there's some sort of gaps there where one would say, well, if you want to draw in food and health plans, regulating the health plans, one would think that you would also be talking to people such as societies, associations of dietetics, the Public Health Association of South Africa, the South African Association of Food Science and Technology, Guilty and Digital Bioscience, and then of course the Consumer Goods Council of South Africa. And there are various mixtures of professional organizations, scientific organizations, industry organizations, and then of course hybrid organizations that sort of cover aspects related to both industry and in science. So those are the types of people who I think really could make really great inputs into specifically regulating and managing health claims on foods. And again, I think one of the big issues here is foods. And are we talking about stuff, or are we talking about the pills and the tablets and whatnot we find in may say census gets, where you have these literally hundreds and hundreds of unregulated products claiming anything, and I really like the arrhythmically shaped and crushed hands. So that's a really great example of the nonsense that we do get and that we should get rid of. Just in terms of definitions, and this should surely be left to the lawyers, I think. But there are definitions, or there is a definition for health claims, internationally recognized definitions, things that we can draw from. One of the big concerns is the whole thing of there's no definition for a medicinal claim. I mean, sometimes I think, although we really need a clear definition, I think it is almost reasonable to think that we can get a good idea of what it meant for it, but I suppose for legislative purposes, a good idea does not cut it. These are just definitions of foodstuffs, and I actually, this morning when I came in, I thought I would say something about this, but the definitions are clear, and I'd like to see a clearer definition if you get to that to the legal people. The next point was about impact. If you look at that logo there, it says fortified for better health. This is one of those logos where you could read a lot of the definitions of medicine you could read into that. I also know that this logo was formulated and created based on a number of potential probable health messages or health claims that could be made on fortified food. We see their treatment, we see mitigation, we see prevention of disease, we see restoring, maintaining, correcting, modifying maybe. We see that in those words, fortified for better health. Now this logo is actually a Department of Health logo, which is used in the food fortification program, which makes it mandatory to fortify all wheat flour and maize flour. And I've made a couple of photographs. You see the little logo there, there's one on maize flour, on maize meal, and from there on maize meal. I think the point here is that the proposed legislation would probably have an important impact on how we deal with a really major public health initiative from the Department of Health on the one hand. On the other hand, it's difficult, at least for me as a scientist, to gauge what the implications would be. I would imagine that words might have a few days with seeming conflicting sort of regulations, in the sense that it would have impact on advertising, it might have impact on giving free food out. Probably the most basic and most general example that you can think of. Of course, there are others that are really within a grey area that are really debatable. But this, I think, is a really important public health issue here. So what we would like to propose is that at least in the interim, we remove foodstuffs from the current to achieve these things, a merged, unified, aligned panel of social health, formulate clear definitions, and then assess the impact of the proposed changes and definitions of food security, food prices, advertising, providing global trade issues here, especially the export section, and then most importantly, at least. The public health implication. Thank
you. So, for last time, but I'm more confused than ever now about the concept of food. Would you be happy to be food stuff as a definition? Bill, but have another definition in this bill which would refer to food with food supplements, food substitutes, and food additives. Because we hear from the Department of Health that some of these claims, you know, some of them are valid, some of them are not so valid. And looking for qualifications. So would you be, I'm trying to get around this now, because as you're talking, I'm writing down the words that are coming out, and I'm now looking at food additives, because that's the 45 story we're talking about. Then there's food supplements, which you, you know, and then the things you refer to are sometimes food substitutes, which makes, you know, sense that people have those ways if you take the food place of what. So, if we were to maybe say food that makes it and into all of this, would you be happy with it? The other definition makes sense.
I think, I mean, in general, my first response would be that we get a proper definition of a food supplement. I'm not sure, as far as I know, we don't have one. It might be that the directors of food control, I know they are working on regulations specifically around food supplements, so it might be that there is an existing definition of a food supplement within the directorate. To say, well, yeah, food additives, I think it would be very difficult to categorize vitamins and minerals that are added to foods as food additives. I mean, probably technically, I'm also again, I'm not 100% sure, but I'm not sure that would be at least should constitute a food additive. I mean, something like vitamin C, for example, is in fruit juices are routinely sort of it falls apart during the heating processes and then is routinely added back into fruit juices, for example. And I'm not sure if that's the route one should take. I think very clearly, I think something like, I mean, the typical pills and shakes, things that for example, do not add energy, for example, could be a sort of a guideline. But there you would have all these protein shakes and weight loss shakes and those types of things. So I think it is really difficult, and for that purpose, for that purpose, we've said, well, let's talk about what exactly is it that should be in or out, and maybe for the interim one, and this is what our submission is, that maybe for the interim we should just remove it and hammer out those details and then go on with another amendment.
Thank you, Chairperson. I heard the presenter referring to free food. I wonder into which context are you talking about referring to it? Are you referring to free food as a product and under the bonuses or what? I just didn't understand why you referred to free food. And you referred to incorporation of the food into this bill since 2004. Is it just a rumor or is it something that you know was practically happening and people were not being consulted from there? Thank you, Chairperson.
Professor, you talked about the need for lawyers to have a field day and that we should hand over the problem because it's too confusing. And we're here for the specific reason to make a complex issue simple. And if we can't understand and decide what should be done, how do we expect the public to be protected by lawyers? You know, this is not an academic exercise. So back to the issue of definitions. I'd like to ask, Chair, through you, if the department intends to have definitions. They have definitions in the Foodstuffs and Cosmetics Bill. And there's no reason, did somebody say something? Yes, they will have definitions there. We've got some definitions in the Medicines Act. We've got definitions for a medicine. We're looking at whether we should remove product because it confuses the issue and be more specific. There's no reason why the foodstuff definition in the Foodstuffs Act can't be brought into this one as well. The medicine definition we know. We will put in this definition for medical claims. We don't have a definition for the products in between, and there are a whole lot of them. They're complementary medicines, they're supplements, etc. The department is considering having such a definition because they will need it for regulation. So could they give us the definition so that we can look at it and just get the matter clear in our heads, see where foodstuffs end, where alternative and complementary medicines begin, see where the traditional medicines is included in that, see what sort of supplementary foods are included in that, and then see where medicines come in. And if we can see that simply and clearly, then the regulations will follow simply and clearly, and they'll correlate with the different bills. I'm sure they do talk to each other, but they don't talk to us very often. So this is our opportunity of getting this all simplified and aligned and understood so that we know where regulations, which body deals with regulations over which matters that most appropriately. Could the department help us, Chair?
Could I maybe ask, answer the first two questions first? The free food samples, we're talking about things such as emergency relief. things such as school feeding schemes, you know, where things are distributed. That was the type of context that I was talking about. And then, yes, I know for a fact that in 2004, at a flag meeting, it was raised that, you know, the possibility of foods being I don't know whether it's the correct term, but being regulated under the MCC regulations. It was talked about, but that was the last that we'd actually heard about that in the Food Legislation Advisory Group.
You're making this particular point that in terms of your own view, there may be, will I be right to say, similarities or convergences between what is defined as medicinal claim versus what is defined as a health claim? But is there no fundamental qualitative difference there?
It's something that's been almost endlessly debated. There's this continuum between what is nutrition, or at least what is a physiological effect. You know, the fact that we are thirsty, we might drink water, but in certain cases, giving water might actually fit into the definition of being a medicine. So there's this whole vitamin A is maybe even a better example. You know, where you can have vitamin A as a sort of physiological role, but you can also have vitamin A in therapeutic doses for a therapeutic purpose. I think with the whole advent of what we call functional foods, in other words, foods that have somehow been enhanced with either things being added or taken away, which might have very specific measurable physiological functions. I think when that started to come onto the market, regulators didn't really know what to do with this, because now all of a sudden you have something that's not a food, it's not a medicine, it's something in between. And this is something that globally regulators have been struggling with for a number of years, and now we are also struggling with it. So I do think there's quite a lot of guidance from international organizations and how other countries have dealt with it. I mean, the FDA has been mentioned. They are really very liberal in the way that they deal with it, whereas the European Union is a lot more conservative and sort of they drag their feet in a way, but they do it a lot, a lot better in many ways.
Thank you very much, Jim. First of all, I just want to assure the professor that this is one department. There's no directorate, DOH, versus everybody else. There's no such. And there's a very clear reason why we didn't want in this act at this stage to actually repeal the other act. We wanted them to actually work parallel so that we can clarify those issues. But what you're saying does not say remove foodstuffs from this bill so that we deal with this issue first, because we actually are losing an opportunity to have an overall body and then clarify which issues will belong where in the process. Because, as you say, it's a very hazy area in many ways. If you take, for example, this the two definitions that are in front of us are not a problem at all. There's no conflict because one is a medicine, one is a foodstuff. If you go to the previous one, where you were talking about food fortification, the one may regulate at what level you can actually have that fortification. The other may say if you move into this higher than this level, and then it begins to get into the realm where it would need to be regulated differently. That's the challenge I think Honorable Waters has been engaging with very, very closely in relation to the RAS issue. You know, because on the one hand, our own directorate, food control, was saying this is the food, don't register it. On the other, there are other parties, some of them are sitting here, that were arguing that you should actually register it because it makes certain claims. And this matter went to court. And these are issues that cannot be settled very easily. So it's important for us to have an overarching body and then look at the details and the perimeters of who does what in the process before you say, let's clarify all the issues and then repeal one act because we now have an umbrella act. The two of them can coexist at this point in time. So it doesn't preclude what you are saying about conversation between the two parties. But finally, Chair, the process is an open process. We publish these things. People are called upon to write and then to engage with us. If they don't take that opportunity, they don't. You then don't say afterwards, well, we need to engage more because you didn't engage. You were invited to actually come and engage with the department in a public process. And you make your choice not to engage. What you are talking about is the committee that actually did this consultation. The department, in presenting this legislation, did a whole range of things in terms of engagement.
Just briefly, I think in 2004, when this was published in the first draft, we actually did make a submission, and at least a whole number of food-related organizations did become part of the process. And I think the reason that so many of us are here today actually indicates that there's this general feeling that there has not been too much consultation, at least with the food and health related groupings and organizations. I think it's one of those disciplines where in many countries people say, well, you can cook, you can eat, and therefore you can be nourished. And nutrition science has moved way, way, way beyond this. And I think on this exact interface of, you know, between medicines and foods, I think there are some really interesting public health issues and problems that we can actually solve. And again, maybe just to respond, I think we are really supportive of having this overarching organization, because if we can get everything under one umbrella, then we will not have this thing that we have these two almost seemingly separate types of legislations being tabled, whereas the one actually takes over where the other one has left off, which it just shows me that there's a lot of opportunity with maybe a little bit of effort to get one thing on the table.
Thank you very much, Professor Tering. Members, do we go for lunch? No. Okay. What time is it now? It's 1:00. We proceed? Thank you very much. Lunch. Two o'clock, we're coming back.